come back again. We're going to dive into the book of John. Jesus is explaining to his disciples and both the insiders and outsiders, Israelites and Gentiles, who he is and why it matters, what we should do in response to that. So I'm expecting that in your response today to the truths that you're going to fill up the room with energy, okay? And I know you might have a mask on, but I'm going to, by faith, I'm going to believe that under that mask is a big smile full of energy. And don't tell, if it's otherwise, don't mention it to me, okay? We're going to talk specifically today about troubled hearts. Jesus has this great phrase in the scripture that says, "Let not your heart be troubled." And it occurred to me as I was thinking through and praying through this scripture text today that for most of my life, it's my faith that has answered the question, why does my heart become troubled? My faith in Jesus answers the question, why does my heart become troubled? It also answers another question, which is, what are the things that bring peace to my troubled heart? Both those questions are answered by Jesus. And there's a lot of troubled hearts in our world today. A lot of troubled hearts probably watching here from our live stream. A lot of troubled hearts here in our church family that's meeting together. But here's the big idea that we're going to see in John chapter 14. Jesus tells us that if our troubled hearts want to see, know, and be with the Father, right? If that's what our troubled hearts want, we want to see the Father, know the Father, and be with the Father, then we'll rest in Him alone. We will find our rest in Him alone. And Jesus explains how and why that's possible. And you might think that's impossible, because you have a troubled heart, and there's lots of reasons for troubled hearts. You or someone you know and love might be really troubled on the inside because of their own fear of the future. Some anxieties, frustrations, and fears related to what's going to happen in the future. What are the circumstances going to be like? How is it all going to turn out? Whether it's some diagnosis you've received, whether or not you're having some kind of conflict and trouble in your family and marriage and you're not sure how it's going to turn out. Maybe you're uncertain as to what's going to happen with your kids because of the path that they've chosen to take in their personal lives. Or maybe you've got your eye on this virus and you have some anxiety and fear related to whether or not you're going to get sick. What's going to happen to you if you do get sick? What about the people that you love getting sick? What's going to happen to them? Other people have said regularly to me recently that their hearts are troubled by the upcoming election. What's going to happen in the election? What's going to happen to our country? Some of them kind of semi-joke, are we going to have a country after this upcoming election? What's going to go on the outside publicly and on the inside in people's lives and homes? And what about the aftermath? Some people have gone so far as to say, if this is kind of nearing some kind of apocalyptic end, I'm concerned about what happens to me after I die. Of course, the pastor gives counsel that this is not the apocalyptic end. It's another election. And every 4 years, we can't see it as a apocalyptic ending. You ever notice it's all the election years that Jesus is going to return, and if the other party's president gets elected, the country's going to end, right? They've been, I believe, saying that since the founding of our country. But there is a lot, as you know, a lot of upheaval, frustration, and fear and anxiety related to what's going to happen in the future. And that's troubling. Those things trouble our hearts. You know what else troubles our hearts? Watching the news, keeping up to date, watching people's responses and reactions. And I would think that we're only troubled because we don't have Jesus with us, but I know that's not true. And I know that's not true because if you follow Jesus and his disciples, you know what you're going to find in his disciples? A lot of trouble. They're fearful and anxious and uncertain. And one of the reasons is because in John chapter 13, Jesus drops this bomb on his disciples. His disciples, mind you, had given up everything to follow him. They had abandoned their careers and their families and friends, their hometowns, to follow Jesus wherever they took him. They had fully committed to the mission. They had fully committed to being Jesus' disciple. And he eventually drops this bomb on them. Hey, I'm not going to stay. I'm leaving. All of a sudden, there's upheaval among the disciples. All of a sudden, the disciples, you can imagine, slipping into a low-level panic. That news of his departure must have been devastating. Thinking about what they had given up, thinking about what they had planned in the future, because don't forget, they had decided already in their mind that Jesus was going to have a glorious ruling and reigning position. And in their minds, it was probably going to be Jerusalem or in Rome, and he was going to be a political center of power, and they were going to share that glory with him, and they were counting on that. They were going to be in power with Jesus on the earth, and it was soon arriving, and all they had to do was kind of see it through and follow Jesus. And how did they know that was going to happen? He was already healing people. He was already raising people from the dead. Jesus, for sure, was going to be the new king in the new city, and they were going to be there, and they were going to enjoy that glory together. But then Jesus goes on to say, and not only am I leaving, but pretty soon Peter is going to deny me. And you imagine the disciples thinking to themselves, okay, Peter is fearless. Something is going to happen in the future after Jesus leaves that causes Peter to deny Jesus. What could it possibly be? How devastating could this upcoming persecution possibly be if Peter wasn't going to be able to stand up to the coming test? The disciples had a great task to fulfill, and they were committed to this task as long as Jesus was leading the task. Healing, deliverance, raising people from the dead. Sure, that's Jesus' job. We're following along. But now Jesus is going to leave, and he says, in all authority that's been given to me, I now give to you. Go and make disciples. And they're thinking to themselves, we're going to make disciples, but not without you. And Jesus has dropped this bomb. I'm going to leave. I'm going to be gone. And here's what you see. The disciples are fearful. Thomas is fearful. Philip is fearful. The disciples are full of fear. They do not know what's going to happen in the future. This is the disciples who have hearts, and they have human hearts. It's the same kind of heart that you and I have. We're troubled with fear about what's going to happen in the future. Fear of what's coming. That Jesus tells his disciples that he's going to depart, and he's going to go. Now, this is what Jesus says. Now, don't forget, I'm going. I have to go because I'm going to prepare a place for you. I'm not going to stay here because our permanent dwelling place, our home, the place where we find ultimate rest is not here in Jerusalem or here among Rome. Our dwelling place, final dwelling place, is in heaven, and I'm going there to prepare a place for you. I'm going to go there, and I'm going to prepare a reception, and I'm going to receive the bride. I'm the groom. My church is the bride, and I'm going to receive this bride. But there's a disciple named Thomas. And if you've been around the church family long enough, or the Bible long enough, or your Christian faith long enough, you probably know Thomas has a nickname. What's his nickname? Doubting Thomas. Why does he have that nickname? Because he's a Red Sox fan. I'm kidding. I don't know if he was. He probably was. I don't really know. Doubting Thomas. How would you like that nickname? Spending your 3 years of your life following Jesus, right? And then you pick up the nickname that you're the guy that doubts Jesus. That's you. You're that guy. Well, when Jesus says he's going to prepare a place for him, Thomas has a doubting reaction. And specifically, here's what Thomas says. Lord, let's be straight here. We don't know where you're going. I can appreciate you telling me that you're leaving, but in fact, we don't know where you are going. And also, not only that, but if you leave us stranded here, we don't know how to get to the Father in heaven where you're saying you're going to be. We don't know. In other words, Thomas is saying, I'm afraid that we're not going to be able to find you, to get with you, to be with you, to see where you're at. And ultimately, I'm afraid we're not going to be able to end up in heaven where you say you are going. And Jesus, of course, responds to him. And he helps to settle his heart. And before he does, we identify that there's another disciple, Philip. And Philip is struggling with dissatisfaction. He's dissatisfied. So I want you to think, I mean, here's a question for you. If being doubting Thomas is bad, the only thing I could think of that's worse is being dissatisfied Philip. Dissatisfied Philip. Jesus is explaining to them where he's going and what he's doing. And somehow Philip expresses that he's unsatisfied with Jesus. He is, this is what Philip says. So he gets the news Jesus is leaving, and Philip doesn't doubt what he says and where he's going. But here's what Philip says. Philip says, okay, before you go, what we really want and what we really need, what I'm asking you to do is I'm asking you to please, would you just show us the Father in heaven? So Philip has been with Jesus for a few years and still wants to know, what's the Father in heaven like? Who is he? What is he like? Could you please show him to us? And this, of course, is the same as others have said. Moses wanted to see God's glory, and a whole line of other people wanted to see God. And yet, somehow, after 3 years, Philip had missed what Paul describes as the light of the glory of God that's found in the face of Jesus. And Philip missed it. Thomas doesn't know how to get where Jesus says he's going. Philip doesn't know who God is, even though he's been with God. He still doesn't recognizing that they are beholding the Father in the face of Jesus. Look what Philip says. Lord, show us the Father before you go, and then we'll be satisfied. You know what that means to me? He isn't satisfied with who? With Jesus. He is unsatisfied with Jesus. Being with Jesus is good, but it wasn't enough. What he really wanted was to see the Father. So listen to what Jesus says. Jesus actually describes to Thomas and Philip, who are uncertain and unhappy, two disciples, uncertain, unhappy, full of fear, full of frustration, anxiety. And Jesus tells them, look, what you have been doing in the past, from the Old Testament, the systems of worship, the ceremonies, the festivals, the tabernacle, the temple, I want you to know that those religious rituals are not capable of getting you before the Father and cleansing you so that you can appear before him and so that you can see and be seen by him. They're only temporary ways of worship. Jesus is saying to them, what you have been doing hasn't been working, and I am the one who's replacing that old system of worship. So I want you to change gears for a second and think about this. Thomas and Philip, their hearts were fearful and dissatisfied. But I want you to think not about them, but think about yourself. I want you to consider, what brings our troubled heart the peace it needs? When you need peace, where do you turn? When you need peace because your heart is full of anxiety, frustration, fear about the future, about what's coming, about what's ahead, I wonder if you would think about your present fears and dissatisfaction with your life. Now, some of you are thinking about this. You ought to be reminded that you already have Jesus and still experience that troubled heart. You already have Jesus. And one of the reasons why we still have this kind of fear and this kind of dissatisfaction is because we have Jesus, but we have what I might describe for the purpose of a picture is a Jesus salad. What does that mean? That means our whole life is a busy, busy salad. And one of the things that we put into the salad that we're juggling and trying to keep track of and keep up on is Jesus. It's a whole bunch of things packed into our lives, a whole bunch of things we do, a whole bunch of things we treasure, a whole bunch of things that we try to keep up with. And one of the things that we've peppered in there and kind of sprinkled on the top is Jesus. And what I want you to consider is that Jesus is not just an add-on on the salad of our lives. He isn't a topping on the main course. That, in fact, the way Jesus has to become way more than just the hero in our sermons and the subject, the object of our songs. He, in fact, is our assurance and he is our satisfaction. And he, in fact, is only available in Jesus. Here's what he says about our troubled hearts. Jesus says, I am all you need to bring peace to your troubled heart. I'm all you need. You don't need anything else. You don't need to go anywhere else. You don't need anyone else. You don't even need the world-class preaching from your pastor every Sunday. You don't even need that. Here's what Jesus does say. Turn with me in John chapter 14. If you have our message notes in the app, you'll see it right there in front of you. But John chapter 14, verse 6, Jesus tells his disciples, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one can come to the Father except through me. If you had already known me, you would know who my Father is. From now on, you do know him, and you have seen the Father. You have seen him. So here's what Jesus tells him. Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Have you heard that before, right? Jesus says, I'm the way. What does that mean? Well, here's three specific descriptions of what those three things mean. The way means this, the road. I'm the road that you must follow in order to be saved. We talked about this a few weeks ago when Jesus says, I'm the gate. The gate is narrow. There's one single gate. There's not many gates. It's not a wide gate. And by the way, the wide gate or wide path, the wide road, many find it. It leads to destruction. But Jesus is a narrow way, a narrow path, a narrow road. He's just a one single entry gate. And the sheep that go in by that gate are saved and protected by Jesus. He is the one road. He tells him that Jesus tells them that he alone now offers what Israel looked for and what they needed. They needed to approach the Father and be approach God in heaven and be cleansed. The one true God, and he is him. And Jesus says, I replaced all the other systems set up as a temporary means by which men would relate to God. Now you relate to God by going my way, following my path through me. These old systems in and of themselves did not cleanse people. It did not make people acceptable to God. They are inadequate ways to know and see and enjoy God. And Jesus saying, there is now a way in which you do that. And it's not the old way, it's the new way, and I'm the new covenant. So, by saying, I am the way, he says, I'm one way back to the true God of Israel, the God of the Shema. There are not many paths to God. There's one. There's not many roads that lead up to the divine mountain and everybody meets on the top. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago. There's nowhere else that anyone needs to look or can look to find the true path of God. Salvation, Jesus says, runs exclusively through me, and I offer it freely to all as a gift if they would believe and receive. There are not multiple ways of salvation, Jesus is teaching. By saying he's the way, there's not a customized path for every individual. You can go out and find your way, and it's going to be unique to you as you actualize your own uniqueness. And then God kind of says, well, I'm going to save you through your own path in a custom individualized version. There's not a custom way to the Father in heaven depending on what culture you're in, what people, tribe, tongue you are, what denomination you are, what nationality you are. It's not whether you're male or female or what way in which you express your own sexual identity and gender. It's all the same for everyone. We must die to ourselves, repent, believe and trust in Jesus, and ultimately believe in the one who the Father has sent. That's what Jesus is teaching. He also says he's the truth. What does that mean? It means this, the authentic image of God that you must see to view his glory. If you want to see God's glory, there's one actual, authentic, identifiable, real, original image of God. And Jesus says, I'm the truth. I am the standard by which everything else is going to be measured. And on the eve of the crucifixion, Jesus takes some time to explain this to Philip. And he says to Philip, he who has seen me has seen who else? You know this. Who has he seen? The Father. Philip, if you've seen me, can you imagine Jesus saying, what? Philip, what are you asking? Hey, fellas, do you hear this question? What a knucklehead. And Thomas is like, finally, another knucklehead. Someone else besides me. Philip is saying, so can you show us God? And Jesus is explaining to him, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. So he says, how can you say, show us the Father? It's a blunder, Philip. You totally missed it. The light of the glory of God is in my face. It's in my person. It's in who I am. So in what way is Jesus the truth? He already explained it previously as well. In the Gospel of John, Jesus tells us, we see it's recorded, the Word was God. The Word was with God, Jesus, and the Word became flesh. He incarnated, and we beheld his glory. Who is that? The God of the universe became flesh, and we saw his glory. It's in the fleshly covering in the man, Jesus himself. Jesus goes on to say, if you had known me, you would have known my Father also. He also explains that no one has ever seen God, but the unique one, Jesus, who is himself God, has revealed God to them. Jesus is the unique one. revealing God to all of them. All of this is in the Gospel of John, which was written for us to see Jesus for who he is and so that we may be prompted to believe. He is the actual, authentic, genuine version. And by the way, if you study the authentic and the genuine version of God through in the person of Jesus, that helps us detect other counterfeits, other phonies, other false teaching, phony truths. And the only way to do that is not to study the counterfeits, it's to study the real thing, the authentic and the genuine picture, image of who God is. It's all discovered in Jesus. Jesus is the life, meaning he says, I'm also the life, the source of explosive power, we talked about this last week, that you must believe and receive in order to overcome the grave. I'm the way, I'm the path, I'm the truth, I'm the image, the exact image, the authentic image, and I'm also the life. I am the power. I have life in myself. And apart from me, no one overcomes the grave. Everybody's dead in the grave. But I was raised from the grave, and the same spirit that raised Christ from the dead will also bring life to your mortal body as you believe and are joined to Jesus. And Jesus says, I embody the indestructible life of the ever-living God. It's found in me. And we dove into this pretty deeply last week. Short time after, I youth pastored for a long time years ago, and short time after I got out of youth ministry, I came across one of the youth group graduates who had gone on as a young adult and had kind of grown and taken his own path. And I had a conversation with him, and I said, tell me a little bit about what you are learning now in this young adult phase of your life. And he said, well, one of the things I learned is that I was raised in a very rigid faith. And I was intrigued by that because I was a part of helping raise this young man in his faith. And I was very curious, like, what is the rigid part of the faith that he was raised in? And he went on to say, I now believe it's more open and loving to raise children to see Jesus as one of the very good options to finding God. He went on to explain this, that I'll raise my children to be open to all the ways that God might reveal himself to them, no matter what unknown brand of religion it is or what known brand of religion it is. I want my kids to be open, their eyes open, their ears open, their hearts open, their minds open to whatever God reveals about himself in whatever religion he reveals himself. And then he said, because he's come to believe that it's more loving to let your kids choose their faith than to force just one religion down their throat. And I found this as an intriguing conversation. So he perceived that his faith was rigid because we were Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. All the time, only Jesus. And honestly, I've thought about this conversation quite a bit. Short time after I had this conversation, I had my own children and started to raise my own kids. And I've often thought to myself, I don't want to be the dad who has kids who are adults who say, well, when I grew up, it was like, holy cow, I was in my dad's church. He was pastoring a church, and all it was all the time was Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. It was like, oh, the gospel this, gospel that, Jesus this, Jesus that. And I certainly don't want to be toxic with my kids, or I don't want them to reject my Jesus. I certainly can picture them saying it was just jammed down my throat. They don't say that now, by the way. Now what they say is VeggieTales was jammed down their throat. I was like, well, that's your mother. She wanted that. I wanted Jesus alone. So we, as normally, we don't want to be intolerant and exclusive, right? We don't want to be that. We don't want to put people like my friend in a position where they're kind of raising their kids and saying, well, you know, I believe it's unloving to give them one choice. But C.S. Lewis talks about this. C.S. Lewis is an author, philosopher. He wrote about this, and he calls it a trilemma. And he said there's basically a trilemma with Jesus and his claims. And the trilemma is this liar, lunatic, and Lord trilemma. And there's one foolish thing, C.S. Lewis says, that we must never say. And it's this. Jesus was a good moral teacher, or something less than the only way, merely one of the many ways of God. So my friend who was talking to me was actually saying what C.S. Lewis says is the one foolish thing we should never say. And he basically describes, C.S. Lewis does, that this one foolish thing is to say, I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. C.S. Lewis says, that's bananas. And here's why. Because Jesus says he is the Son of God. He is the way, the truth, the life. There is one way to the Father. It's through him. He says, I am the Father. If you've seen me, you've seen the Father in heaven. And what C.S. Lewis goes on to say is that you cannot accept all of those things that Jesus said and see him as only a good teacher. Because if he believes he's the Son of God and the one path to the Father in heaven, that the actual exact image of God, if you believe that's true, and you believe he's only a good teacher, then what you have to decide on is Jesus the Lord he says he is, or is he a lunatic? If you don't believe he's the Lord, then obviously Jesus is kind of gone bonkers. If somebody told you today that he or she was the incarnation of the living God, when you see them, you see the God in heaven. Come on. Are you with me? Would you kind of cringe a little bit? You certainly wouldn't think they might be telling the truth. They might be the Lord. Here's what you would think. They either are that or they're a lunatic. Or they're just lying. So here's our choices with Jesus and based on his own claims and his own words. He's either crazy. By the way, C.S. Lewis says he's either a madman or he's something worse inspired by the demons in hell for saying such things, for these claims. It leaves us one option. And one option only, and we have to decide, is he a liar, a lunatic, a Lord? So my friend was saying, I want my kids to be open to the possibility that Jesus was the Lord or maybe also a lunatic or just lying. And this kind of begs the question here, how then should we live? How do we respond if Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life that he says he is? Let me ask you to consider this. Would you consider, based on what Jesus is saying, about troubled hearts, soothing your heart and soothing your heart with trust? Your heart is either troubled or it's trusting. It's full of trouble or it's full of trust. It's not both. Would you consider soothing your troubled heart with trust? The effectiveness and strength of faith are bound up in the greatness of the dependability of God in whom our faith is rooted. And some people, without trusting Jesus, are soothing their troubled hearts in vengeance. They want to get back at the people that have betrayed them, get back at the people who have stabbed them in the back or who have otherwise exploited them, taken advantage of them or someone that they love. And some people find their hearts being soothed and satisfied in their revenge, in the way that they want to get back at somebody. Other people just don't want to think about it, and they settle in every night with a bottle of wine. They numb themselves. They medicate themselves so that they don't have to think about the things that trouble their heart. And they're soothing their heart in some kind of substance. It could also, of course, be overeating those foods that bring so much comfort and overindulging on those foods and comforting our hearts in those foods. There's lists and lists of ways in which people escapism, right? Turning to one addiction or another to get our mind off it, to somehow numb our hearts or escape the reality of the trouble that we're experiencing on the inside through fear and frustration and anxiety or being dissatisfied with life. Here's what we've learned about all those other things that we turn to. They cause more trouble. And most of us find that after we turn there, we are more troubled than when we start. We add trouble to our hearts through those things and all kinds of other things that we add to it. One of the authors that I love and oftentimes come across, Hudson Taylor, put it this way. Have faith in God. This is what trusting and letting him soothe your heart with trust means. Have faith in God. That means hold God's faithfulness. Don't let your heart be troubled. How do I do that? Hold on to the faithfulness of God. And when you do, and if you do, there's nothing that you need. There's nothing that you lack. He's the one that provides purpose for living, to know and love and serve God. He provides you direction for your life, to please God. That's my direction. That's my new direction. I'm settling my trust in God, and that's my new direction. And I also have hope in death. So in my life, I have, through Jesus, purpose, direction, and hope. I know a lot of people could use some of that. Jesus said, I'm the way, I'm the truth, I'm life. That's how it happens. And with hope and death, you have an eternity to look forward to where you're spending it with God. Secondly, start your search for truth with Jesus. Specifically, if you're a young adult here and you feel like you're launching out from under your parents' roof, and you have heard your whole life, it's Jesus, 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 and Pastor Dan is gospel, 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 all the good news of who Jesus is and what he did, the person and work of Jesus, on and on and on, and I'm just going to get out and find a truth for myself. Can I ask you to do something for me? If you're a young adult or you're in maybe a midlife collapse around you and you're trying to figure out, now where do I start? Would you consider starting with Jesus? And if you dive into who Jesus is in his own words, not the counterfeit Jesus, the biased Jesus, a version of Jesus, but the Jesus who describes himself in his own words, the real Jesus, here's what I want to promise you. If you start with Jesus, you will not need to continue your search because you will find everything you need and want is in him. Also, you will discover that you don't have to hit rock bottom and have a come to Jesus moment before you finally turn back to Jesus. Like so many of our loved ones who leave the church when they're young and they quote unquote leave God. And if you ask them one day, why did you leave Jesus? They'll describe leaving the church. They'll describe leaving crummy Christians. They'll describe leaving legalism. They don't describe leaving Jesus. Oh, I didn't want all of God's grace by faith alone. I didn't want to be saved as a free gift. Wait, what? Nobody says that. What they do is they reject the things around Jesus. But you won't have to experience a come to Jesus moment in your life when you discover that Jesus is the only truth, who represents God perfectly, and who promises to bring me home to heaven. You will not have to keep looking into other religious leaders and philosophies whose leaders and heroes are dead in the grave. Because Jesus is the only one who has overcome the grave. And if you start with Jesus, your search, the real Jesus, your search will end with the real Jesus. Start there. Dive in there. We have a church app where we put a bunch of resources on there that says basically discover Jesus. And there's so many different ways you can discover him on your own that same way. Also, lastly, I want to encourage you. If you have kids, you have grandkids, you have nieces, nephews, you have neighborhood kids that you love, love your kids away from pluralism. It's not toxic. It doesn't have to be exclusive. It doesn't have to be painfully rigid and legalistic to love your kids away from this idea that there are multiple ways to God and that every faith system is equally valid and valuable. That's called pluralism. Christians who trust Jesus are exclusivists. We believe there's one way, one truth, one life. It's Jesus alone. And we should love our kids away from pluralism, which is what my friend told me he was going to say. He said, I love my kids, and I'm going to love them into letting them explore all the options about truth out there. If you believe Jesus to be unique, if you believe Jesus to be essential, if you believe Jesus to be true for salvation, how about this? It's unloving to allow someone to explore other options. It's unloving. It's unloving to say to our kids, we believe there's one way to heaven, one way to be saved, one way to overcome death, but I want you to get out there and discover all the counterfeit options because I love you. You know what I'm saying? I mean, wouldn't we think our kids need some serious help if they come to us and say, hey, Mom and Dad, I had this idea. I've decided that it's so much easier to use monopoly money in the world than real money. First of all, it's cheaper. Second of all, I don't have to work all week to earn real money. I can use monopoly money. And if you and I were told by our kids, listen, this monopoly money, it's more accessible and I have lots of it. It's super cheap on Amazon. We want them to know that when they get out there in the world, it isn't going to work. You are going to either, if you trust in this counterfeit money, you are going to end up in jail or they're going to send you to to get some mental help. It's only loving to teach them what you believe, to be an exclusive truth for seeing and knowing the supreme and real God. And you can't ignore this truth. Jesus is the real currency. If you get out in the world and try relying on something else, it's not going to work. I mean, we do the same thing when we teach our kids about fire, don't we? I mean, we don't say to our kids, We don't think in our hearts, it's more loving to let my kid discover that fire is hot. I like to say things to my kids that scare them away from fire, like, if you touch that, your skin will melt off your body and you'll only be a skeleton. That's all you'll be. I don't mind using fear. But if you wholeheartedly believe that fire will burn your child, it's not loving to say, I don't want to cram down my kid's throat. I want them to discover their own truth, right? We don't say that. And so we ought to know that we have the power in us to love Jesus and to love our friends, family, kids, children, grandchildren, nieces, and nephews enough to say, I love you enough to tell you that I believe that Jesus in my own heart and life has exclusive rights to our hearts. He doesn't share us with other truths. And I want to encourage you, young one, little one, to start with Jesus. And it, in fact, is more loving to hand off something or someone that we know to be true. Our hearts are either full of trouble, I said this earlier, or full of trust. And when we trust, we view Jesus as infinitely worthy of our whole life of worship, infinitely worthy of adoring worship. Anything less demonstrates an incomplete view of who Jesus is. He is the way, the truth, and the life. And he said, Jesus tells us that if our troubled hearts want to see, know, and be with the Father in heaven, we'll rest in him alone. Father, we pray together today that you would come alive in our hearts exclusively as the only way, the only truth, the only life that we need. We pray today that you'd give us insights and ideas on how to love our kids into this.